and Ocean Avenue, or committee proposed Ocean Avenue Fund 3 commitment. And all of you had a placement booklet, I think, on your, in front of your chairs this morning.
Is it a correction from the one that we received in the mail? And where's the correction?
I was told that it was, well, correction or improvement, or Tim, you might.
Which one are we going by?
There was one sitting on the desk. New one versus the old one?
On the desk.
The one sitting on the desk, so.
What changed?
The one got mailed, everything was wrong.
That's what I'm wondering, what happened?
The day of the performance as of should be as of 2015. And the old version was as of 2014, so it was typo.
Labeling issue there.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, move to item six, then?
Yes.
So we have a staff recommendation to commit to Ocean Avenue Fund 3 within the private equity program. This would be a follow-on commitment from our prior engagement with Ocean Avenue. We have ample capacity within the private equity program both today and on the programs that are envisioned under a new asset allocation that'll be presented next week. So there's no prospective issue that we see in terms of committed capital today. Positive experience to date. Deborah will address the pacing issue that you brought up there, but I'm going to turn it over to Chi-Chi. He did all the heavy lifting on this one, and he'll walk you through kind of our thought process here.
So when I look at Ocean Avenue's portfolio, the companies they invest are probably the smallest company in all our portfolio. And I always view them as the most direct access to U.S. economy. So these are the companies probably with revenue less than $50 million, many of them with cash flow no more than $5 or $10 million. These are good companies, but perhaps they are not run the best way they could be run. Some of them may be in temporary trouble, some in special situations, or some are just looking for capital to grow the business to bigger, either through merger or through some spending. Any of you watched a CNBC show called Profit? Yeah, I always, remind me of that show when I see these companies. But they are probably on a bigger scale than the company you see on Profit. Two of the firm's four senior partners, they actually have a special situation investment background. So this would fit them very well to help these companies out. I'm very impressed with them as they have established to be the go-to firm for a lot of the independent sponsors. And at the evidence of that is, if you look at the page 5, the table at the bottom. If I can only show you one number, this is probably the number that I'm most interested is the, if you look at the third row from the top is the percentage in co-investment. You can see the increase significantly of the co-investment percentage from fund 1's 25% to fund 2's 49%. So for the next fund 3, they are targeting at 60% of the investment will be in co-investment. So this shows us they have a lot of the deal flow coming from the independent sponsors. So they are able to increase the co-investment percentage.
And just a little reminder on why we look at co-investment differently. Co-investment gets to a direct investment in the end company. So it's the idea would be brought forward by a fund sponsor who needs additional capital. They're able to come to Ocean Avenue as a trusted partner and say, if you bring additional capital to this, you participate directly in the company, no management fee, typically no carried interest on the deal level, and the economics flow through to the limited partner more directly. So we like to see that. Where they have a successful track record in co-investment, it's great to see. Co-investment is somewhat of a buzzword today because it does lower the management fee and everybody's looking for this as the positive. To the extent you can execute successfully, it's great for the limited partner. To the extent you can't execute successfully and you're just getting co-investment deal flow from everybody, it's a real big negative. So seeing these folks around and engage in that co-investment for a long period of time is what gives us some confidence to move forward here.
Tim, on these co-investment fees that are paid, we would elect to invest in directly in the company, does the company, is it precluded from paying a commission back to Oceanic for referring us directly to them?
As far as restrictions and contractual elements, I encourage you to ask that question directly of Ocean Avenue when they present in a moment here. But generally speaking, the structure that we go into, all of our fees are paid to Ocean Avenue. They can elect to deploy that capital into underlying funds in a traditional fund-to-fund structure or go direct. The end company is normally going to have the relationship with the underlying fund sponsor. And so it's usually when Ocean Avenue comes in, somebody else is already involved. Some other private equity sponsor is already involved with that end operating company. They may have shared some fees there. When Ocean Avenue comes in, it's usually in recognition of Ocean Avenue's relationship with another private equity sponsor and not on a commission basis. But it gets convoluted quickly, so let's let them address that.
Okay. To my understanding is independent sponsors are not placement agent for those companies. They are they are investor in those companies alongside with Ocean Avenue.
Okay.
So the performance for Fund 1 is quite strong. If you look at the top table on page 5, they have distributed $66 million out of the $94 million contribution, and for a vintage year of 2011, that's quite impressive. Fund 2 is still too young to tell, but the deployment pace is quite strong. And going back to Deborah, you are looking at that number. That number is lag number. Probably.
What is it now?
Right now, the percentage of the committed and invested is over 80% right now.
Of Fund 2?
Remember that this is a kind of a hybrid fund-to-funds approach. So you commit to the underlying funds, and then they draw down through. But you also probably have reserve for projects that are not yet deployed. So the dollars we've sent over are relatively low. The dollars they have allocated are high, and that's why they're moving on to the next fund here. And so, we've sent over 35%. They've mentally allocated to 80%. So that 45% gap, that is already spoken for. That's going to flow through. It's not recognized on our statements today. Okay. But from their perspective, that money is deployed, and they're on to the new opportunities.
They are called for it.
Where are these idle funds parked in the meantime?
With
that
us?
Are not called?
On our side? Typically in U.S. equity. We normally draw down through our lowest transaction cost U.S. equity program, which today is PIMCO.
Yeah, I just spoke to them earlier this morning. By the end of the year, that number will become 98 or 95%. I forgot.
Of funds sent to them to invest?
Of funds committed. Allocated.
Yeah.
Do you have a sense of the timing of when these funds actually become invested?
That'll happen over about the next 18 to 24 months for it to be fully called through.
Yeah. And part of the features of Ocean Avenue's platform is through the independent sponsors. So this will call capital much, much quicker than the typical fund you see. And that's why you have such a quick deployment pace from Ocean Avenue.
Well, I know it sounds like a long-term deployment phase.
It doesn't seem quick to me for four years.
In private equity land, I mean, we look at a typical fund of funds that commits over 3 years to underlying funds who in turn commit over 3 to 4 years. The commitment pace can actually be up to 7 years on a Pathway or Adams Street fund. This, we're looking at 36 to 60 months. Yeah.
So is this one of the deals where we are paying fees on commitment?
Yes. Fees are on committed capital.
Right. I was going to ask that question. What are our thoughts on that? Is that something can be negotiated? Is that just the way it is? Is that a private equity thing versus something else?
See, most of the private equity funds are set up this way, and for them, at least they claim they will deploy the capital into commitment quickly. So, you know, they want to still charge.
So is that a negotiable item? That is the time that capital can be committed versus invested. Is that in other words? If these are ignorant questions,
we're shading into gray area where I really prefer to have some of those conversations in closed session, but we don't have that agendized today.
Okay. So I think this is a good segue to look at page 8 with the commitment prior and after picture. So historically, the small cap private equity is underrepresented. So as you may notice, what we have been doing is try to scale down our commitment with the large fund of funds, takes longer for them to deploy the capital, and scale up the small cap buyout funds. So this investment would help us move toward that direction. Because historically, if you look at the return and risk profile, sort of the chart, just look at from the from Scott's presentation, the small cap buyout do have a better risk and return profile. So next section is risk. I want to pause for questions. If you have any question on the risk.
We would stop you if we did.
It's a shy group.
So last but not the least is the table I'm going to refer to, John's table from now on. It's the fee projection. So the fees you see here include the fees Ocean Avenue pay to their independent sponsor if they are successful, the fees they pay to their fund managers. So this is all in field. Probably the split is 60-40, Ocean Avenue, 60% and 40% goes to the underlying manager, the rough split.
Chi, could you make a quick guess if they, instead of 10% was zero?
Yeah. The carried interest goes away. The management fees
will be there.
Remain constant.
Yeah. Okay.
What does your comment about Keyman? I'm not sure I understand this.
The Keyman provision is triggered so that if any two of Jeff Ennis during current Curis or Chuck Yusufmir leave the firm, they cannot make any further commitments.
They cannot make any further
commitments. They have to stop future activity if two members of that team leave.
But for us, even one man leaves, for us, we would think it's...
You would come back to us.
It's a risk.
But in terms
for
of
us.
The contractual setup of the limited partnership agreement, this is the way it reads today.
I mean, because I see Jeff Ennis as a necessary part of that, and if he decides to leave, I would be really wanting to know right away.
Okay. So without getting into the weeds on questions that might be handled in a closed session kind of environment, are these like the standard term sheet conditions from which you begin a negotiation?
This falls in between standard and a reflection of the relationship here. So look, maybe big picture, you know, what do we try to accomplish here? We try to move fees to alignment of interest where the fund sponsor gets paid when there's successful investments. And there's enough to keep the lights on in the meantime. Real simply, that's what we try to get to. where the private equity world now is, they get paid no matter what. And so we've seen kind of this steady stepping of private equity, you know, kind of coming back towards the limited partnership interest, but a huge disparity between different shops. So we've got big goals of, we don't want to pay fees if you're not successful. That would be perfect. That would be wonderful. But, you know, we're trying to get the alignment. So it's not always that we pay only on invested capital. It's not always that we only pay a low management fee. It's not always that we try to get the, you know, the key man provision and to be as tight as possible. We have to look at this, you know, really as a matrix where we're trying to move in aggregate towards a better position for the limited partner for Sisera. But this becomes, there's a little bit more art than science to that structuring process. And quite frankly, smaller firms have different economic structures than larger firms that have been around for 20 years. With smaller firms, you're going to pay a higher management fee because they're not receiving carried interest from seven funds ago.
Right.
And we, you know, we always try to get to what is the best net result for Sisera. So are we attacking an area of the market we think is particularly attractive? And Chi-Chi walked you through, you know, the fact that this is targeting smaller companies where we still see attractive valuations today relative to the large buyout world. It's a small shop, so, you know, there's going to be a little bit more give on the management fee there. There's carried interest, yes, but there's a preferred rate of return at 8%. So we're trying to move, again, you try to get the whole package right. Moved in our direction, you might give or take on any individual key term there.
Yeah, I was curious. Actually, the thing that got my attention was the no-fault divorce, which in my world we call a termination for convenience, but same concept, right? Somebody decides without cause or fault that they want out of the deal, and it looks like this takes a 75% vote to do that, but the GP gets a year's worth of fees in that scenario. Is that, my question is that standard in the industry?
I couldn't comment on whether that's standard or not.
Just curious. Okay.
But typically, if we are looking for a separate account, then we have more levers to pull in terms of, you know, deciding the terms of the fund.
And in this case, we're not, right?
Yeah, these are standard offering from the shelf.
Yeah.
So we're looking at 50, just to summarize, we're looking at 50 million on a potential 300 million
350,
fund.
Up to 4, yeah.
Okay, so.
Yeah. And then we check with them. They've done separate account from the very beginning, but they no longer offer that. So even we want to do a separate account with them,
you know,
there's no such offering. And probably a lot of it is because of the capital they are raised. This is a small companies, so they write smaller checks. If you give them 200 million to do a 500, 600 million dollar fund, they probably don't have that much investment opportunities to look at today.
One last question. In looking at page 5 on the Ocean Avenue performance summary, Fund 2, you've got there a net IRR of 5%, vintage 13. Is that your projected end of the fund IRR?
No, this is point in time.
Where we're at right now with that fund?
Yeah.
Yeah, the projections would be, I mean, I think the target is mid-teens. Candidly, we're not far enough along in that fund to judge this.
To know.
We can give you projections, but they're going to have a high degree of variability around it.
And they're 28% on the fund. Well, it's all right. I'll ask them these questions.
Yeah.
Okay. So, any other questions of Tim and Chi-Chi before guests come in?
Time to make a motion?
Might be a little early.
Okay, I think you're ready to hear from them.
All right. If yours may die for lack of a second.
No, I'm just remembering last time when I... It wasn't you, it was me, Obi.
Good try, Scott.
Thanks, you guys.
Bye, Scott.
See Scott. Yes, either. Okay. They left. They got a better offer.
Good morning.
By the way, thank you for allowing us to change our schedule slightly and waiting. Appreciate it.
No problem at all.
If you would like to introduce yourselves and then start into your presentation.
Okay, well, great. Well, thank you very much for having us. Thank you for your support in our Fund 2, Ocean Avenue Fund 2. We're here to talk about Ocean Avenue Fund 3. And since we've been in front of you before, we're going to try to be a little more brief on some of the introductory comments and get into a refresher on our strategy and to an update on our performance since we last met. Feel free to interrupt at any time with questions or to redirect us in any way you'd like. So if you turn on your presentation to slide 3.
Let me ask you to introduce yourselves.
Your name?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Jeff Ennis. This is Joran Curris. I was going to do that on the next slide.
All right.
And we're with Ocean Avenue Capital Partners.
Good.
So just an overview of what we'd like to remind you of our strategy, our team, our innovative approach, discuss the unique opportunity we see in the market for our strategy, and review our track record with you. So if you turn to slide 4, this is what we do. Really what we seek to do is generate outsized returns in the private markets without taking commensurate levels of risk. We want to be overcompensated for the risks that we take. To do that, we only invest in what we consider less competitive and less efficient markets, which we define as small and or complex transactions where there's much less competition. Everything we do with a partner. We either do it with a fund manager partner or with a transaction partner on a deal-by-deal basis. And that aspect is fairly unique to how we run our strategy. To generate outsized returns, we limit our total assets so we can focus on the most attractive opportunities. The phrase we like to use, we want to have more good ideas than capital to make sure that our best ideas go into the portfolio. We seek to create value on the buy by going in these less competitive markets and maintain upside optionality, and hopefully you'll see that in some of our outcomes. And we're looking to build better assets. So we're not trying to generate returns through financial engineering. We're trying to invest in companies that can be improved and with our partners make fundamentally better businesses that we then sell 3 to 5 years down the road. We aggressively manage costs and fees. That's a big theme. Duran will touch on that in a moment. And we insist on best practices and governance and how we operate as a firm and our products and who we partner with. So a little more detail on the team. As I mentioned, I'm Jeff Ennis. To be brief, I co-founded a private markets business at a Santa Monica-based firm called Wilshire Associates in the mid-1990s. We built that up over 15 years. I left in 2010. And with me for 10 of those years was Jacques Youssefmire, the third name on the list. And then 8 years ago, we hired Anthony Lucetta into Wilshire, who's the second from the bottom. So Jacques and I left in 2010. And then we partnered with Duran, who we knew from industry. We're the three founding partners. And within a year, we hired Anthony Lucetta. So the three of us have a long history back at Wilshire. Duran's going to talk about the rest of the team who worked together at another firm. And importantly, we've worked together as Ocean Avenue now for 5 years. So we've been together. We have we use the term high-performance team. It comes from the management literature, where we have unique backgrounds. Different skill sets, but all with the same goal, and we run our strategy. Just a couple of other things. We outsource our fund administration. We don't have that in-house, so that's really an extension of our team. And we plan to add two analysts next year once we have a final close on Fund 3.
So I'm Duran Curris. I started in private equity in 1998 at a firm called Pacific Corporate Group in San Diego. I actually worked with Pete Notes and Matt Dedrick as well. So I hired Pete Notes in 2006, and then Matt joined in 2008. So as Jeff mentioned, you know, the three, Pete and Matt and me, we have a long history of working together. The common theme for all the team members is that we have a long history of working together even prior to Ocean Avenue. So there's continuity within the whole team. So if you look at the next page, slide 6.
Jeff, out of curiosity, how many employees do you currently have in the whole firm?
That we have 6 at Ocean
Avenue. 6 right now? Yeah. And you're planning on hiring 2 if the close
is? We'll have 2 more next year. And that, again, that doesn't include, one of our themes is to keep our fixed costs down, so we have a third-party fund administrator. We used to have that in-house at Wilshire, which equivalent would be another 3 or 4 people, but we think it's a more efficient for everybody to have that outsourced.
Gotcha. Thank you.
So on slide 6, this is just, I wanted to illustrate our sponsor network to you. So if you look at the slide on the left side of the slide, March 2013, that's when we started Fund 2. So when you invested in Fund 2, this just shows you the logos here of our existing network of partners, our fund manager partners, and our independent sponsor partners. So if you fast forward now to September 2015, when we essentially started the process for Fund 3, we've continued with our most productive relationships on the fund side. We've also significantly added to the bench of relationships on the independent sponsor side. So if you add everything together right now, we currently have 22 active relationships with both fund managers and independent sponsors, and those relationships will continue to provide deal flow for us into Fund 3. And also it allows us, given the base that we have, the base of relationships we have, it allows us to be highly selective at this stage in terms of the number of new fund managers or independent sponsors we add to our network. So if you look at the last 5 years, Ocean Avenue has really built a brand, tremendous brand value in the marketplace, where we're now considered the go-to source of capital for investments in the very small end of the lower middle market. So if you look at the last 12 months, we've cast a pretty wide net. We've looked at 270 investment opportunities with 172 unique sponsors. So it's a pretty high bar for us in terms of adding new sponsors, both funds and independent sponsors, to our platform.
So just to be clear, we highlight this. We consider it really as an extension of our team. So these firms are out in the market. They have unique specialization in different industries, different transaction types. They're sourcing transactions. We're reviewing what they're bringing and deciding as you know, these 270 opportunities, which ones we want to invest in. We do very thorough due diligence alongside them. If we decide to invest, they're the sponsor, so they're managing the investment on a day-to-day basis. We have board observation rights and information rights to oversee the investment, but they're running the deal day-to-day. So, you know, I like to say that we have our core team, and then we have another 100-plus people that are effectively working for us every day, looking for these opportunities, and we're trying to pick the very best ones that go into the portfolio.
So on the next slide, slide 7, in terms of the market.
Yeah. So just to be clear, do the independent sponsors get paid by bringing the companies to you? Get paid by the companies?
They only get paid if we make the investment. So the fund managers will get paid according to the fund terms. So with the fund managers, what we do is we'll pay fund economics, we'll pay a fee and a carried interest, and then we seek to do transactions alongside the fund, co-investments. On those, we pay no fees and no carried interest. And you'll see the volume we've done in a couple of slides. The independent sponsors, we don't pay anything unless we make an investment in the company. And then we don't pay any fees on our capital. We will allow them to take a monitoring fee out of the business, a very modest fee, and they get paid on the back end when the company's sold. And there's a tiered profit sharing that we negotiate with those managers. So as Duran will talk about in a moment, that has the effect of really reducing the front end costs to this strategy, which is part of what we're trying to do. We're trying to reduce the fixed costs. One of the things we saw throughout our career, if you have too many people, looking for deals and you're paying them, through, whether or not they find the deals, it can become very unproductive. So the front end costs get very, very high. And so by doing on a deal by deal basis, we can reduce that, as well as get, more selectivity and have a broader network. And we think we have a broader network of people that are much higher quality than we could hire as full-time deal professionals in the firm. So we think it's a better way to go after this segment of the market.
Jeff, with maybe a slightly different angle, the ultimate firms that are receiving the money, do they ever pay fees back on co-investments to either the sponsor or to Ocean Avenue?
So we don't take any fees from the underlying companies. The sponsors that we partner with, we allow them to take typically 3-5% of EBITDA for the role they're playing in these firms. And that has to be approved by the seller, who oftentimes is rolling over their interest. So if you were selling your business, Duran was a sponsor coming in, we do a lot of transactions like this. A lot of times you'll say, I'm gonna sell 55% of my business, I'm gonna roll over and retain the rest. You're doing that to take some money off the table, typically for estate planning, and also to bring not just capital but expertise to help grow your business to the next level. It's a private company recapitalization.
So it's the seller bearing the upwards of 5%.
So that in this example of the EBITDA for the year, somewhere between 3-5% will be paid to Duran in that case. The reason we like that structure is that the company has to support it. So for whatever reason the company's not performing well enough, that fee doesn't get paid. And there's also a cap on it as the company grows. And it's also an add back at sale. So when we go to sell the business, we're selling off the gross level of EBITDA. And finally, in that example I just gave you, if for whatever reason Duran's not adding value, you're going to be the first one to speak up and say, why am I paying these fees? So we think it's a much better governance model, much stronger alignment of interest. And in all of our transactions, they're very actively sponsored, where, in my example, people like Duran are really active with the business almost on a daily basis. And they're sourcing add-on acquisitions, recruiting a new finance professionals, for example, upgrading technology systems, very, very active. So we think it's a very much of a win-win situation for all those involved.
And then, so just on this slide, I mean, there's a lot of charts here, but I just wanted to just illustrate the segment of the market that we're focused on, small and or complex. So if you look at the slide on the top left, so essentially under where the circle is, that's our target market. So if you look at fund sizes under 250 in terms of the amount of the availability of companies in that segment, so that's the blue bar, the number of companies. So obviously, it's a very deep. The larger the bar is, the deeper the segment is. So there's orders of magnitude larger amount in terms of number of companies than the other segments. Then also the percentage. The percentage is the amount of private equity capital targeting those transactions. So it's a measure of competition in that space. So that's obviously when you're on the low end on the percentage wise, that's more attractive. And if you look at the similar profile on the next slide to the right, again where the oblong circle is, that's the segment of the market that we're focused on. Fund size is less than 250 million. So this basically shows you the percentage of fundraising per year in private equity by fund size. So essentially what you have is the shades of green are the larger fund sizes, and they're essentially competing with each other for effectively the same companies. So it's very competitive, which again ties into the chart on the bottom left side in terms of purchase multiples. The more competition you have, the higher the probability that you're going to bid up prices. So that's the brown and the green bars in terms of historical purchase price multiples paid for the larger companies. The blue bars are the area of the market, segment of the market that we're focused on, so historically much lower in terms of purchase prices, which then translates to the chart on the bottom right in terms of long-term returns, historical returns for that segment of the market. Particularly the small cap segment has outperformed both on a 5-year basis and a 10-year basis. So the next slide, we can talk a little bit about, this is just to talk about the mechanics of the management fees, both the direct management fees and the indirect costs. We run a very fee-efficient model. That's a hallmark of our investment strategy. And so this was a similar slide, actually, that we presented for Fund 2. So I can walk you through this. So if you look at the box on the left side, we have three different structures. You have the traditional fund-to-fund structure, which is a fee-on-fee structure. On the far right, you have the direct fund commitment structure. So that's just a direct private equity fund that typically has what they call a 2-in-20 model, so a 2% management fee and a 20% carried interest. Then you have our model in the middle, where effectively the difference there is the fact that 60% in this fund, 60% of the capital will not have a management fee associated with that. So what that means is that's going to drop directly to the bottom line. So if you look at the bottom box in terms of total management fees actually paid by the investors, we're 120 basis points lower than a fund of funds. That's why fund of funds have been particularly problematic in terms of being able to deliver returns, because they had such a high fee load. And then we're actually lower than a direct private equity fund, but at the same time, we are able to give investors a level of diversification in their portfolio by investing with multiple sponsors across a portfolio that you can't achieve in a direct private equity fund. So you get the benefit of diversification actually at a lower cost than a direct private equity fund. The other factor is two other things that are particularly important too, as well as the indirect costs. The first one, underinvestment, that's particularly pernicious, mainly because investors are paying fees on committed capital. So what happens when the fund only invests between 60 or 70% of the capital? Well, your effective management fee becomes close to 3%, which is really massive. If you think about that over a long period of time, that's highly dilutive to the returns. So you have these very large spreads between the gross and net returns. Also, the investment pace affects returns. So if you have a longer duration, the longer it takes for you to deploy capital, the longer it takes for you to receive distributions back. And those investments that are made later in the fund's life have an effective load on them from all the cumulative management fees up to that point. So that's why we're particularly focused on managing the duration, having shorter investment periods. And for example, our Fund 1 is fully invested. So it's going to be 100% invested. It's 98% drawn now and will be 100% drawn.
And that was started in 2011?
2011, yes.
11 or 12,
12. Four and a half. 3 years.
Four and a half years, I believe it is. Okay.
So if I can ask, what are the institutional structures that you have in place to ensure faster investment of capital? I mean, what, in other words, you can talk about it in qualitative terms. I guess I'm trying to understand lag is.
We have a shorter investment period. So our investment period is effectively 3 years. And we're committing to funds and making direct investments. So any fund commitment we make, they start investing in their investment period. And those are typically 3 to 5 years. And then during that first 3 years, we're making direct investments alongside them. So in effect, we're able to get these funds over 50% invested in a couple of years. And that is the case with Fund 2, the fund that you're in. So by virtue of us having a shorter investment period, which is why we've come back in 2 years, mm-hmm. Our view is we'd rather come back every couple of years. You get to review what we're doing, again, to our governance model. And the alternative would be, well, we'll have a 4 or 5 year investment period, but if we're charging you fees on investments we won't make until years 4, 5, and 6, as Duran just said, that's a very heavy load. So we're not charging that on our product, and we're trying to reduce that with the underlying investments that we're making. So we're really trying to minimize the time that there's fees on committed capital where the money's not invested, but at the same time maintain some of the benefits to get some vintage year diversification. So that's our way of really reducing that gross to net spread. So the investment pace and fully investing the fund, basically helps us capture a lot of the return leakage that we've seen take place in these funds over the years.
So just on slide 9. So this just illustrates our portfolio to date. So we've segmented it out in terms of the co-investment transactions. So the co-investments are those direct investments we've done alongside of one of our fund managers. So we have an investment in the fund, and they've offered us co-investments. We pay no fee or no carried interest on the co-investments. And also our independent sponsor investments. Those are transactions we've done with groups that do not have a fund. Therefore, we're obviously not paying a management fee to them or on the deals, and we have a tiered back-ended carry structure that we have a very strong alignment of interest on. So if you look at The totality of these investments, it sums up to 50 transactions we've completed since Fund 1. As I mentioned before, we have 22 active fund and independent sponsor relationships that have allowed us to have a highly consistent level of deal flow. And you'll see that these the bar charts there in the middle, the direct investments by year, particularly in the last 3 years, but starting in 2012, we've been averaging about one deal per month. And that's been very consistent. That's because we have these relationships that are giving us a lot of transaction flow. And we're able to underwrite those transactions and actually doing repeat deals with them. So if you look at year to date, with the pending transactions that we have right now, it's somewhat seasonal. A lot of transactions are very fourth quarter heavy, meaning we're very busy this time of year. You have a lot of transactions that need to close prior to year end. We have five to six transactions in the pipeline at advanced stages, so we'll actually be at 12 to 13 deals this year. So we think that pace will continue on into Fund 3, given the fact that we have this very established sponsor network that will continue to bring us transactions.
So we've talked about our strategy, the markets we invest in, our cost structure. I think we've demonstrated that we can find these investments and put them in the portfolios. The next question is, how do they perform? So the most mature portfolio was Fund 1. That's on slide 10. And this is the most meaningful performance because it's got some seasoning to it. It's about 4.5 years old, as we were just discussing. So this fund is fully committed. So I just want to highlight, on the third bullet, you can see it's 98% paid in. So that's actually in the money's in the underlying transactions. Of that, 81%'s been distributed, and this is as of October. Now, when we were here to discuss Fund 2, Fund 1 at that time was 81% paid in and 45% distributed. So we've made continued progress on that. And you can see the performance down below as of June, about 1.75 times return and a 28% IRR. And those are both increases in this fund since we were here last. That was 1.43 and 25.5. So you can see how that compares to the underlying benchmarks. And we think actually the distribution of paid-in capital ratio is really the most meaningful, because that means that a very high percentage of the return is determined by cash distributions back to the investors. It's not based on unrealized marks and value. We do have two fairly significant transactions that are expected to close either by the end of this month or early December that we think will put this fund over 100% distributed. So we'll have over $100 million, the original $100 million, distributed back in less than 5 years. So we're very, very pleased with that, and that directionally is what we're trying to do. We're trying to take in the committed capital enough for 2 to 3 years for us to build these portfolios, get it invested productively in very interesting transactions in these inefficient markets, and then get those realized sooner rather than later and get the money back to our investors. And we're doing exactly the same thing with Fund 3. The only thing that's different is that we have a larger network of sponsors because we've been at it longer and been able to build that out. So on slide 11, this is just some of the realization events that contributed to that return. When we were here last, the three at the top had been realized. Since then, the next four have been sold. HD Vest should close any day now. It's under contract. And then U.S. Pipe, the second from the bottom, is one of the ones I mentioned that's supposed to close very shortly. So this is what's been delivering the cash back.
Are these all U.S. domestic?
There's one Canadian business. It's NSC, the second from the top. But I would say 95%+ of what we do is the U.S. Occasionally, we'll see some stuff in Canada. It's a North America focus, U.S. On slide 12 is Fund 2 as of June. So the performance here is not, it's too early for the performance to be meaningful, and I would say that even if this showed a 50% IRR, it's just that the average duration of the companies in this portfolio is very, very short. So it can really whip the IRR around. There's a couple things that are meaningful, though. It's 82% committed as of this month, and we expect to be 97% committed by the end of the year based on the pending transactions that Duran mentioned, and we have a pending fund commitment. We also expect it to be 61% invested. So it's on a similar commitment investment pace to Fund 1. And we won't start to see, we don't think, meaningful distributions until sometime next year, again, because the average duration of the investments is probably about 6 months, and it takes at least the early realizations start to come usually around year three. So we do have six transactions pending. We have about $22 million of capital and one fund commitment, and that's what would contribute to the build out of Fund 2 and why we're talking to you about Fund 3. So the completion of Fund 2 is imminent.
So the six transactions, those are co-investments?
Yeah, they're listed on the next page, slide 13. The three at the top have been closed since the June numbers we showed you, a co-investment, a fund commitment, independent sponsor transaction, and those that are pending are just below that. So it's a mixture of independent sponsor, co-investment, and one fund commitment. And there's actually a few others behind this that there's a chance that one or two could close in December. We think they're more likely going to be in the first quarter. Slide 14 is a summary of terms. There's really two changes and one effect for you related to that I want to highlight. The first is Duran mentioned, a minimum of 60% of the capital in this fund will go directly into transactions. For Fund 2, that number was 50%. So that enables us to offset another 10% of the underlying 2% fee, as well as another 10% of the underlying 20% carry. So we're slightly increasing our fee, but we're doing it through increasing our share of the carried interest from 7.5% to 10%. We're taking no increase in our management fee, so we'll only get that increase if the fund performs, we deliver all the capital back, plus the preferred return, and then we can take a little bit more carried interest. So we think net-net, the investors are actually a little bit better off under this structure because we're certain we're going to offset the underlying fees, and we'll only get any more for ourselves if we deliver the performance. The other thing is on our fee scale, Contra Costa committed $30 million to Fund 2. That was an 85 basis point fee to Ocean Avenue. I understand you're contemplating $50 million. If that's the case, then it'll be a 75 basis point fee, so it'll be a lower fee because of the larger commitment. Other than that, all the other terms are substantially similar. Now, we're targeting $250 million for this close with a cap, or for this fund, with a cap of $300 million. Fund 2 was $207 million. We have the four largest investors are Liberty Mutual Insurance, a large Swiss foundation, San Joaquin County, and Contra Costa County. The other three have already completed their due diligence, and we have documents in. They're committed to Fund 3. And if we're
how much money has been committed so far?
So about $100 million.
Okay.
Yeah, from those three.
Three.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if we're privileged enough to get another commitment from you, that would put us around 150 or so, and that would be the first close. And we're doing that by design. We went to the largest investors in Fund 2. Our view is our existing investors should get priority on any new capital we raise. We have a few smaller investors that we're talking to. They'll participate in a second close. And we have quite a bit of interest from potential new investors. So at this point, we have more interest than we can take. So that's why we're going to our existing investors first, see what they want to do. And once we know what they want to do, we'll determine what's left over for any potential new investors. So that's the... our core presentation in terms of what we prepared. We have some case studies. We're happy to pause here, answer questions, and we can give some examples, whatever you'd like to do.
Jeff, I have one quick question going back to page 13, where we have three closed investments. Would you describe with a little bit more depth what closed means? What do you have to do in order to meet that test?
Okay, these are completed. So with just that the performance data we showed you was through June, and since June we closed a co-investment with New State in a company called NWN. So that's now in the portfolio, but it's not reflected in the numbers as of June because it closed I think in August. And we committed to Tribe Capital in September, and Mikawai I think closed in August or September. Yep. So those are now in the portfolio. The remaining investments are pending. We're in advanced stages of due diligence, and we think probably all but maybe one of these is likely to close before year end.
How do you value these? As you know, we have to recognize a value, market value. How do you determine that?
So all of our partners are required to value them using GAAP fair value, so generally accepted accounting principles, fair value standards.
Is it book value then?
No, it's a mark to market, and that's audited. All of our underlying investments are audited once a year, as are our funds. So we basically review their audited fair value numbers that their auditors have signed off on, and we have our process to make sure that we agree with that our auditor holds us accountable to. That happens once a year for the December audited financials. And then there's fair value adjustments at each quarter, but they tend to be skewed towards year end because that's when the auditors are coming in and looking at the values. But that's basically the industry standard, and we follow that. And to be clear, there's no fees paid on any of these values. Any of the carried interest or the profit sharing is only based on realized companies, so they have to be sold and generate cash before any carried interest.
This is a curiosity, I guess, question. An auditor signs off on a determination of fair value different from book value. And normally the auditor would opine against what effectively is book value.
Yeah, well, so there's the, I think it's FAS 157 says that you have to show the financial statements of these funds have to reflect the fair value of the underlying.
Now, this is the fund auditor,
yeah.
Okay, not the underlying company.
Oh, no, yeah, that's correct. It's the fund auditor, not
so
the
underlying company. So level one, two, or three, that's what you're describing? I think that's how they're described.
That's correct, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I'm talking about the fund auditor.
I assume they're all threes? These would all be?
Yeah, these are all mark-to-market level three.
Level three.
Right.
Yeah.
In other words, it's not on the exchange, obviously.
That's
so.
No. That's right.
All right. So it's the fund manager who is determining the value.
Yeah, so the fund manager determines it, and they basically utilize comparables, a discounted cash flow approach, public market comparables, private sale transaction comparables, and a discounted cash flow approach, and some blend of those is used. And so the auditor is looking at what process did you use to determine this value? Do I agree with it? Does it accurately reflect what I've seen in the company? That's what happens. So then we get those in, and we have a process to review all those to make sure that we agree with it, and our auditors are holding us to the same standard. So that's the evaluation that takes place. That takes place, like I said, in the fourth quarter. But there are adjustments periodically at other quarters, typically in June. If it's been held for a year, they might mark it up or mark it down. And a lot of times, the first year, what they typically do is they just take the acquisition multiple, and if there's any change in the cash flow over that first year, they just apply that acquisition multiple to the cash flow to come up with the new value. Some cases, the auditors will force them to use a more recent market multiple. It just depends on the business and the auditor and the circumstances in that particular investment.
It's more akin to sort of the way real estate is.
Yeah, I was going to say, this sounds like
the appraisal,
the independent
kind of
appraisal model. Then. I mean, you got the underlying fund is the market maker. I mean, it's that opinion of value based on the factors you've described is what the mark to market is. Right?
Yeah, yeah. I think real estate might be a little more straightforward, and they actually use a real estate appraiser on every single asset. In some cases, some funds do go out and have a valuation firm value the underlying portfolios. In other cases, they don't. It's just they're balancing off cost with relative accuracy. If it's something that's more complicated and needs that sort of work, then they might do it. But if it's something that's pretty straightforward, they won't.
Okay.
How about the companies for independent sponsors? It's not fun to come up with the value.
Well, the sponsor does that, and that's part of the agreement that we have with them, that they deliver that. So, yeah, that's we negotiate that up front with our sponsor agreement with those independent sponsors.
You will review.
Yeah, and then we – so they have to go through the same process and justify the valuation. They deliver that to us. We review it, and we either agree with it or we don't. And our auditor is determining, you know, our whether or not they agree with our judgment in that situation.
Any other questions of our guests?
I've got one. I think we were presented with some information that – maybe not in your packet, but in our own staff packet, regarding Fund 2 expected to be at about a IRR of 5% right now.
Okay.
What is your expected, realizing that the future is unpredictable, what is your expected IRR on Fund 2? And when do you think, at what year will we get to approximately 80% distributed out of that fund?
Well, I would say the second question, 80% distributed should be around year five or somewhere between year five and six, I would think. We've been able to do it in 4.5 years on fund one. We're targeting 20% returns. That's what our goal is. I think we'd like to at least do high teens. This is what we're hopeful to. It's, like you said, it's very hard to predict the future. You know, there's a number of investments that we're very, very excited about. We know there'll be some that won't go as planned. You know, in Fund 1, you know, we have a write-off that was 3% of the portfolio, and we still have a 28.5% net return. So there'll be some of those as well. What we're really trying to do, we call it a positive convexity return profile is what we're looking for. We're looking for investments we think that the magnitude and the probability of the gain greatly outweighs the risk of loss. So we want to take, as I said earlier, we want to be overcompensated for risk, but we want to take very measured risk where we think it's a low likelihood that we're going to lose our money, but we could get an outsized return. We might, like we have some, we made 7 times our money, we've had some made 5 times our money. So you're not going to get those returns if you're saying you don't have to take any risk whatsoever. So that's our approach. So we think the return profile comes when one of those comes. So it's hard to say if we can get a 5x return on one of these directs that we have in the fund. We feel like we've got a few that are tracking in that direction. That'll be a material event for the fund. But will that happen next year? Will it happen 2017? That's much harder to predict, because that's where, you know, the capital markets and the economy are going to affect the sale timing. So we're more focused on the underlying fundamentals. If we buy well, we have a good partner, and they're really working to add and build a better business, we'll eventually get, you know, the gain. That when we get it is a little bit more difficult to tell, as I said.
Any further questions? Marianne, Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you.